Good evening. I hear that Peter was a big hit last week. I'm so glad. This is his favorite subject, the trust mind little poem. He studied it for many, many, many years. So it was a big treat for him. And I know it must have been a treat for you all, too. My experience was a little different. And it fits right in with our subject. So I thought I would tell you about it. I don't know how far you all got last week. Peter took off for Hawaii as soon as he did this gig. So I don't know what he actually did or said. Thank you. Yeah, that works.
He talked in general.
Not in particular. He didn't go into the lines of it at all. Well, what I was looking at these last few days was I have some notes in here somewhere. Here we go. If you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinions for or against anything. And that sounds so in a way it sounds radical, and in another way it sounds pretty simple. Sure, we want to see the truth. Of course we do. So then this tells us how to do that. We just don't have any opinions about things. But of course, we're racked with opinions. We're overwhelmed with opinions. My experience last Tuesday night was that I could feel where my opinions were coming from in an extremely vivid way. Because I got to where the address was that I had Googled for the poetry reading, 952 First Street. And I parked on Jackson, just short of First Street. And I went looking for 952, where the poetry reading was, and everyone would be waiting for me. And it wasn't there. There was a bail bonds place. There was a hair salon. There was an apartment building. There was a nice teenage black boy who led me around looking with me, trying to find it with me. Trying to help. So I walked up and down First Street for about three or four blocks looking for this address and realizing more and more that I'd made a mistake. And I didn't want to have made a mistake. I didn't want to know the truth. And my mind kept throwing up all the reasons why it wasn't my fault, that I didn't do anything wrong. It was very funny, really. I finally got in the car and I drove all the way down to the courthouse and then all the way back up to 101 and then back on the other side looking at every building to see if it looked like a poetry reading. And of course, they didn't, because it was at Fifth Street where Wendy was outside waiting for me to so she could flag me down. So I was fit to be tied. And it wasn't until I took myself in hand and said, Annabelle, you made a mistake. And I took it in, finally. And I thought, oh, thank goodness, that's all it was. I just made a stupid mistake. I didn't know what the mistake was then. But it took me a while to overcome this flood of excuses, of trying to be, you know, better than I was, you know. I'm somebody who never makes a mistake. Well, come on. It doesn't work like that. And there was a tremendous amount of suffering in that process of trying to make it into something that wasn't true. That the truth was somewhere else. And the more I thought of it later, the more I realized how common this is in our mind, how easily we try to twist the truth in order to make things work out better for us, for us to look better or to somehow. And there's something uncomfortable about that. You would think, I mean, we're doing it so we'll feel better, but it actually doesn't make us feel better. It actually worsens the situation and creates more pain. It was very interesting. And I got home, I couldn't reach anybody. Wendy called me and said there was a big crowd and everybody was worried and I felt even worse. And then I couldn't reach anybody the next day. I had to go all around before I finally reached the person who was in charge because she hadn't given me her number. So I finally reached her and feeling abject. And she said, oh, don't worry, you can come next month. I thought, oh, okay. That was all there was to it. So this big drama was all in my head. All of it. So this whole beautiful little poem is really about this. About how our mind is working and which part of our mind is getting in the way of us and which part of our mind can take care of itself pretty well without our fiddling with it. I've been listening to a very interesting series of talks on Upaya's website. Upaya is Joan Halifax Roshi in Santa Fe, New Mexico. She has she is a scientist herself, and she has over the years, every year, called in the leading neurological scientists who are working on how the brain works. And every year, of course, they know a whole lot more. It's very, very interesting. It's called Zen and the Brain. Some of the scientists, there's a very brilliant one, a student of Bob Thurman's, who is of Tibetan background. There's some Vipassana people and some Zens. And Joan Roshi is also a part of the discourse. Talking about the self, and trying to find out where the self is in terms of how our brain is put together, about the prefrontal neocortex and how it functions in terms of our self, our feeling that we have a self. Somehow we get the feeling that there's a self here. And what they were saying was that there are two sides of it, and it's just what we say in Zen. There is the faithful body that knows already what it's doing. We don't have to breathe our breath or beat our heart. We don't have to tell our body what to do. It takes care of us, if there's an us. And then what they say is that we have experiences. And after the experience, we look back and identify ourselves with it and say, oh, this happened to me. And so then me gets invented. It's just an invention. It's a handy invention, really. What we do is string all those happenings into a long, long line so that then we say, this is me, my life. And this is me, my life, and I'm in the middle of it. And this is me and the universe, and I'm in the middle of it. So there's a kind of dysfunction in it because it leaves out the other. It becomes really a source of suffering because we identify so deeply with our experience that we don't realize that we are a part of a big soup with everyone, and in a sense are everyone. They have done some experiments. There was one where they can measure brain waves and know where the brain, what part of the brain they're coming from. And how did that go? Oh, maybe I didn't write it down. They had people with two people facing each other, and one person was in pain, and they were measuring his brain waves and measuring the other person who was witnessing that person in pain, and his brain waves were the same, coming from the same place and with the same intensity. He was completely mirroring the pain. That it's something that we do in spite of ourselves. And they found that the people who did that the most, were most intense about it, were the least compassionate because they couldn't bear it. It was too hard. It was too much. They did another experiment where somebody was told just to fiddle his hands around. Just wave your hands around. And several other people were in the room, and they started watching, and they started doing it too, and pretty soon they were all in sync. They were all doing it together, and nobody said anything. It was just how it all works together. And of course, here we are, all of us sitting together in total silence in a little room, and yet we're becoming more and more in sync with each other as we sit. There's a that's what Sangha means. Sangha is how this whole thing functions as a body, as a living body, as a part of the living body of life, of the universe. So, being willing to know the truth carries us very, very far if we're willing. And that's what he's saying. Set up what you like against what you dislike is a disease of the mind. We can like and dislike things, but once we begin to set them up and take it on, then all the ills of our culture, of our humanity, come up. So maybe that's enough. That's just a tiny bit of the poem, but it should be time for discussion a little bit. Are questions? Dan?
It was wonderful when I see and hear people talking about the same thing in different groups. So I recently read this book and gave a book report to one of my investment groups about a book called Your Money and Your Brain.
Uh-huh.
The book is about neuroscience and investing. And this is actually not a new area. Pieces of it have evolved. But now they're able to do this fMRI where they can see what your brain is doing and all this other stuff in psychology and economics. And now it's all coming together. One of the things they found, and this is one of many very good insights in this book that relate to practice and self and all that, is that our memories are not merely recollections.
Yes.
We rewrite them.
Yes.
We are actually rewriting them in such a way that, from like an economics point of view, we look like we made the right decision.
Yes, exactly.
Why do we do that? Because we don't want to look bad.
Yes.
Right? We don't want to look like we didn't know what we should have known.
Yes.
But then they actually find out, if you take someone back, you can actually show them very empirically they didn't know all of what they rewrote it as.
Yes.
And the reality of making an economic investment decision at the real time is a lot harder than looking back on it and making yourself look
right. Right.
And that stress is the reality of making decisions. But this constant reminding to yourself and then this rewriting is going on constantly. And especially if people are doing this kind of investing work all the time. They constantly are rewriting.
Yes.
So it's interesting to see how, you're hearing these talks and our practice, of course, is ongoing. And then these books that are coming out, and it all intersects.
It all fits together.
I'm constantly amazed at the revisiting from all these angles of these same topics.
Yes. Yes. The basic insecurity in everyone, we all have a basic insecurity, because secretly we all know that we don't know. We all know that we're walking in the dark. We don't have a clue, really, what's going to happen next. And there's a lot of danger out there and a lot of confusion. And here we are, this soft little animal. And so there's something about how we console ourselves by making our story a little bit tougher and stronger. It's kind of touching in a way. But it gets in our way also, because then we're living in a dream world, as the whole economic system is realizing now, that was an obvious example how we can mislead ourselves and just walk right off a cliff.
Interesting, one of the things that they tell you, I like the way the guy wrote the book, he's a reporter, he's got a very nice writing style. And one of the things he does, he points out all these high-powered insights from all these professor types, and then he writes at the end of each chapter how you might do very practical things to overcome these tendencies.
Uh-huh.
And one of them, which I liked a lot, which relates to our practice, is when you make an economic decision, write down at the time you make the decision, I feel I know this. I feel trepidation about this aspect. I don't know, but I think maybe this will happen. Because those comments are occurring now.
Yes.
And, true, it is words, but it's like there's practice, I think, embedded in that process, that you can try to be as objective as possible now.
Yeah.
And then when you go back and look and say, oh, wow, what kind of decision did I make? But you realize what you didn't know.
Yes.
And that's that almost point of enlightenment, that, oh, it wasn't the way I thought.
Exactly, exactly. And of course, the beauty of our Zazen practice, as we're heading into Sesshin, where we sit day after day after day, we have to see how our mind works. We have to see that we're making, telling the same story over and over again often, or telling, you know, a novel and a movie and a, you know, there are just so many of these things going on in us. And if we take them seriously, then we don't understand our life. No, our life is this life, not that one. And this life is kind of precarious. It's very interesting because it is precarious if we're up for it. But it takes a certain kind of strength, a purpose, almost a vow to stay awake and be with it and do it. Or as Sui Neng said, you get turned by it. You know, then life just keeps twisting and turning you. And if we're able to, what did Roshi called it, being an iron person, you know, being compassionate in a very strong way, ruthless way, ruthless compassion, she said, that there's a way of throwing yourself into life, you know, and just being willing, whatever. It's not for us, really, life. We're born into life, and then we feel like it was given to us, but actually, maybe we were given to it, if you have to talk about it in those terms, rather, that it's not ours. Anything else? Wendy?
Could we look at this whole paradigm in terms of relationships?
Yes.
And like if you share experiences with someone, that creates kind of a bond.
Yes.
And what is your relationship based on if it's not these memories and shared experiences? What do you do with those if you're like trying to live in the present?
You enjoy the present together.
And what if that person is not with you?
But you can be with them. So it may not be reciprocal in the way that you can talk to each other, but unconsciously you're connected. Unconsciously we are always connected to whoever we're facing. So from our side we can always honor that connection, even if the other side doesn't know. It's hard. Well, I have a proposal and a couple of proposals. One is that the sotos, the teachers who talk to each other on email, got into a discussion about a DVD that is out about Dogen's life. And I bought one. They said where you could get it, and they said it was really good. And so I got one. I haven't opened it up. It's still sitting next to my TV. But I thought maybe we could engineer some way of seeing it one of these Tuesday evenings. It was thought that we could hook it up to a computer, and Julian said he has a screen, so I think we'll have to decide when to do this, but I'm proposing that, you know, this is an opportunity that would be very helpful, I think. Also, one of Coben's early students lives not very far from me, and I've begun to be friends with her again, Connie Batten. And she, a couple of years ago, invited us up to her land, which is up farther from me, but not very much farther. Beautiful, beautiful sort of hill with a forest behind, but a great clearing. She wants to do a weekend sit with us and for us up there. And I didn't want to commit unless I knew that at least three or four of us would commit to it. So I'm bringing it up now. I'm not asking for a conclusion now, but maybe in the next few weeks we should be able to tell Connie one way or the other.
When is it,
Angie? It's the first weekend of May, which is, I think, the second and third.
It's the first and second.
First and second. So, we have time to do our 1 minute sit.